If you want to get your favorite technical news, give the Gizmo Gang a call. Gizmo Sapiens!
Hey, and welcome to Gizmo Sapiens show number 150. Yeah, we're at a century and a half mark here.
Nice.
In what, over 10 years? Because we do about 10 to 12, little maybe some years we do more than 12, but we try to do at least once a month. If I had sponsors, I might consider doing twice a month, because then there would be a financial incentive for doing that. But so far, no one has taken us up on that offer. But it's kind of been, I mean, it's summertime, which... I spend a lot of time outside. How about you, Matt?
Not at all.
You're not spending any time outside?
I go out when I have to.
Oh.
I literally go to the mailbox once a week.
Well, that's kind of depressing. Because I'm an avid believer in outside. You need that vitamin D in your, to get your blood going and stuff. But that being said, there's actually a lot of tech stuff that's been going on, which is kind of, it's not unusual, but it's one of those things where things have been moving forward, because I think part of it is, it's just the normal tech cycle, and the tech industry, for the most part, has gotten back to... or is closely gotten back to normal. There's still some delays in the supply chain and getting things, but all of that is really related to way back in January, February, March, when a lot of China shut down. But I think it hastened some decisions by some companies. So probably the biggest thing going on in tech is Apple announced at their Worldwide Developers Conference back in June that they were no longer going to build new Macs with Intel processors. Now, let me caveat that. For the next couple of years, you will still see new Macs, new models of Mac that will have Intel processor. But what Apple is doing is they're transitioning to their own Apple Silicon or system on a chip that they use. And they're very successful at it. The iPhone, the iPad, all of those run on Apple-designed silicone that's they have made for them at TSMC, which is Taiwan Semiconductor. So part of that, from Apple's viewpoint, is they've had some issues with, like, the Intel Skylake platform was kind of a disaster, and it was kind of a disaster for Apple. It's probably their most buggy, from a hardware perspective, product in a long time, and that was something that was out of their control, because it was all to blame on the Skylake chips and the Skylake chipset. And it didn't just plague Apple, it plagued every PC vendor. It's just Apple gets, part of their agreement with Intel is Apple gets first pick, and they a lot of times will pick processors that are from Intel that are have a better TDP or performance versus power. It'll be an ultra mobile version that a lot of PC or that no other PC vendor will pick, or Apple can say, we're going to pick this chip and nobody else gets to use that one, which they've been doing ever since the original MacBook Air. Apple has actually gotten chips that no other vendor has, gets to use as part of their agreement with Intel. But evidently, and I've read a lot on this, the Skylake rollout from Intel was terrible, and there's several Intel engineers who are also product managers who said, you know, Apple was extremely unhappy, and that's when they began to look at doing it themselves. Because way back, I think somewhere around 99, 2000, 2001, Apple bought a chip company that made ARM RISC processor chips, and at the time, it was shocking because that company had a huge contract with the U.S. Department of Defense, because the chips that company made, and Apple had, via an existing contract, Apple had to continue making for several years, were chips that were used in ballistic missiles. So it was actually part of the national defense. But that same company is the company who has designed every chip that Apple has used since about the third generation iPod to the iPhones, you know, every iPhone, well, I don't think, the first and second iPhone, I don't believe Apple actually made the chip. They had influence, but they didn't make it. And then every iPad that's been out there, and the Apple Watch, and the T2 chips that go into Apple's MacBooks, and things like that. Those were all designed by Apple. So going to an Apple SoC, which there's, that's one major advantage is, you know, I don't have to rely on Intel and what they're producing that year to build, you know, to improve my product. The other thing is because they're going to a system on a chip, a lot of the things that we like about the iPad and the iPhone and those extra chips that do, you know, motion sensing and 3D and all this other stuff, that is going to end up going into your desktop Mac. Now, Mac OS is not changing. They're going to, Big Sur, which is the next version of Mac OS, will run on both the current Intel architecture and will run on Apple's system on a chip or Apple Silicon as well. And but the third thing also, kind of the three legs of this of a three-legged stool, I think Apple's getting out of this is that because they're moving to a, they're the first major laptop vendor who's moving to a truly ARM RISC platform. I mean, Samsung delves into it, the Microsoft Surface Pro X, but they're using generic chips that they're buying from other people. And Apple, where they're developing theirs, it's a 12-core. The kit that they have out, the system, or well, I forget what they call it, the transition kit, the developer's transition kit to move from Intel to Apple Silicon. It's a Mac Mini form factor. It has an A12Z chip, which is not something that's in anything else, but it's a 12-core chip, and it is on par. And that's a chip today, is on par with Intel's platform at a huge reduction in power. But it blows, like the Microsoft, they've done some benchmarks between it and the Microsoft Surface X, which is their pro platform for the Surface laptops, and it blows it out of the water performance-wise. And analysts are saying that for the foreseeable future, it is everybody else's is going to be playing catch up, because they're at this point not a generation behind, but a couple or several generations behind from a performance to power perspective. So that's kind of exciting. It gives Apple a lot of flexibility, but the bigger part that I don't think that fourth leg is, it tightens up Apple's supply chain. And it does a couple things when I say it tightens up their supply chain. Right now, Apple's supply chain is scattered across China, with the exception of Apple Silicon that goes in the iPhones and the iPads. That's in Taiwan. If you start reading some of the other things behind the scenes that are going on, Apple has, you know, they've been doing Mac Pro work here in the United States, but that's really not supply chain related. That's more just final assembly. We're doing final assembly in the United States. All the components in it are made somewhere else, mostly in Southeast Asia. But Apple is starting to move some of their other supply chain capabilities to India. That's most of what I've read. It's around India, which, yes, it's arguably can still be talked about as being part of, it's part of Asia, but it's not part of Southeast Asia. And I think there's this movement, and you'll see Apple do it first because they have a much tighter supply chain than Dell, HP, IBM, a lot of your electronic suppliers. You're going to see a lot of it move to India, which makes sense in the first place. But the reason it hadn't moved there before is because prior to COVID, the Indian government wanted to, they wanted to take more than their fair share of the profits for doing so. But now that they need investment because of jobs and particularly high tech jobs where they don't necessarily need people to be in close proximity to each other, they are now welcoming U.S. tech companies. And between Apple, Facebook, and Google, and a couple other companies, there since March, there's been $17 billion in high-tech investment into India. And that's all supply chain related. And I think ultimately that's where everybody was going anyway. It was just hastened by COVID. And a lot of these other decisions were also COVID-hastened tech decisions because the tech industry, partly in China, is in a rut. And the tech companies worldwide, whether you're based in the United States or not, do not want to be beholden to China in and of itself. And I don't think China's manufacturing and supply chain industry is going to go away, but I think it is going to be severely reduced as supply chain now diversifies, so that China is not only, you know, is not your first and second supplier for everything. China might be your second or third for a lot of companies, you know. So there would be more competition in the market. And that's going to change the outlook of China, not just from a economic perspective, but also from a political perspective.
Well, there's reasons why China is making their moves.
I don't think your mic's on.
There's reasons why China is making their moves on Hong Kong. I think this speaks to that.
Yeah. I think you're probably correct in that too, because that was the last really free market. We say free, but semi-free market in China was Hong Kong, and you know what they're trying to rein it in so that they can control this and try to leverage all the other countries in the world who use China for manufacturing, you know. And I see what I originally, we knew based upon things that have happened, like when the hard drive industry, they had all the hurricanes and the tsunamis and the islands, including Taiwan, that produced hard drives, it killed the hard drive industry for a couple years because they just couldn't manufacture product. And so then, you know, supply demand, you know, 1 terabyte hard drive, which was selling for $80, now is selling for $280, you know, that kind of thing. That companies were looking at, you know, to diversify that, because originally there was a lot of investment in Brazil. Brazil was talked about as being the next big place. And even Foxconn, Chinese companies, were looking at building manufacturing plants in Brazil. I think all that ended after they saw what to use a colloquial phrase, the shit show that was the Olympics in Brazil. I think a lot of that changed because they realized that the Brazilian government and the Brazilian infrastructure just wasn't there to really start up a manufacturing. But India, on the other hand, who has a tech industry in and of itself as well. I mean, look at, after China, India is the most populous country in the world. You know, I think they saw that, hey, there's another opportunity. Is it an ideal place to do, you know, all of this? No, but is it are the costs low enough that when you weigh everything else against that, you know, does it make sense? And yes, India makes sense. And I think we'll see other places where we'll see some more diversification of that, you know, high electronics manufacturing and you'll see the supply chain of global companies start investing more in India than what they were investing in China. Because again, China has been, you know, my kids don't understand it because China has been a manufacturing country since they've been born. But I think from your perspective and my perspective, Matt, China wasn't always the preferred place where things were manufactured, you know. I do vaguely remember as a small child when they manufactured stuff here in the United States. That's a whole nother discussion. but, you know, and you know, it's kind of funny. I can remember when stuff was manufactured in Japan. You know, and in a way, we thought of Japan just like we thought of China. Oh, that's junk. And now I go and I look at, you know, Japanese-made stuff from the late 70s and early 80s, and the fact that it still works and it's around, and I go, hey, that's pretty good stuff. And I did work for the U.S. subsidiary of a global Japanese company, and so I'm familiar with, you know, what they do and how they operate and, you know, the innovations they do have. And China, by far, is not anywhere near, you know, the quality that Japan was when we used to think that Japanese cars were junk and things like that. And now today, Japanese cars are luxury vehicles just like American vehicles and German vehicles.
Again, though, I think the propaganda that the Japanese cars, for instance, were junk was more American protectionism.
Likely. I mean, I agree with you in that sense. I mean, I think the first round of Japanese cars, because they were trying to figure out the auto market, it's just like Tesla. The only difference is Tesla's vehicles were over-engineered and the Japanese vehicles had a lot of gimmicks in it. And I think that's why a lot of people associate them with Chinese stuff today. Because, you know, and now we call them gimmicks, but at the time, if you look back on it now, it is kind of innovative, because Japanese cars, and yes, it was all made of plastic, and I think that's where it got the gimmicky, but if it weren't for Japanese cars, we wouldn't have cup holders in cars. The U.S. auto industry was not, they didn't see that as a need, and yet I don't even remember who had it, but somebody had bought a Datsun, which don't exist anymore. And I remember sitting in it, it was an uncle or aunt, you know, and it had two cup holders in between the front seats. And I thought, that's cool, you know, go to McDonald's through the drive-thru and now I have a place to put my drink, you know. And today, if you buy a car, I mean, let's put it this way. If you buy a car, and people actually make decisions on which model of car they buy based on the number of cup holders that are in the car.
That's now a feature rather than a...
Yeah, a gimmick. Yeah. And, you know, and there were several things like that. Although clocks have been in cars since the beginning of cars, it wasn't standardized that every car had a clock in it until the Japanese entered the auto market. I'm trying to think of what else there were featured. Some of it was the movable louvers on the for the heating and cooling vents. A lot of cars didn't have that. You could open them or close them, but they didn't have directional louvers so you could direct the air. That was something that the greater auto industry was starting to embrace. But it wasn't until the Japanese put it in every car they brought. Now that I think that's where it kind of got the junk, you know, because everything they were adding was something that was made out of plastic, and at the time the plastics just didn't have the longevity in the heat and the cold and everything else that they do today, and so a lot of people thought that was junk because, you know, after a few years it would break. Now that being said, the Japanese have embraced the full auto industry lethargic attitude, or The Nissan Rogue, as reported by Consumer Reports and Automotive Week and a couple other magazines, is the worst SUV made. And they said the biggest reason it's the worst SUV made is that you can, instead of a 60,000 mile, 5 year longevity, minimum longevity for a lot of the features and things on the car, that within less than 3 years, most Nissan Rogues require not just normal maintenance issues, but the whole car starts to fall apart. Seatbelts start to break. All those little things, you know, the dash cracks, all the louvers break. And so it's really kind of a junky vehicle. And you wouldn't expect that, you know, if we had talked about that 5 years ago or 10 years ago, you would not have expected that from a Japanese automaker. Because that's actually, the Nissan Rogue is the number one SUV that they say do not buy as a used vehicle.
That's interesting.
But that being said, if you're in the, if you want a cheap car and you don't mind, you know, a lot of the little crappy stuff to break, maybe a Nissan Rogue is the right vehicle to buy. Yeah. Very true.
The key is to be as informed as you possibly can be, and that's, you know, that's my advice on just about everything.
Yeah. Yeah. So, that's kind of my beef and what's going on in the world. You know, as far as the way other stuff goes, it's been a kind of an exciting time here in Ohio. Our Speaker of the House was arrested by the FBI yesterday, which, now that's the Ohio House, not the federal House of Representatives. But, and we're seeing that across the United States. We're seeing it looks like a criminal investigative crackdown on state officials who are doing things that they shouldn't be doing. I'm hoping it's going to extend to the federal house, because I'm sure there's quite a bit of corruption in there too.
I think you will find that the enthusiasm on the part of the Federal Bureau of Investigation
to investigate the federal government is probably pretty low at this point.
I would think. Particularly after the fiasco of what came out through the impeachment proceedings and how tainted the FBI is at the federal
level. Yeah. Very true. Very true.
But to set that aside, the rank and file FBI agent is very competent, very non-political, and very dedicated to justice, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
What you may see at the director level,
well, again, it does become political. Well, and it's really, even though it's an appointed position, it is a politicized or a political position, because you're appointed by some administration or another. That's why I've always questioned why we allow, and even though I understand that it's presidential appointment or presidential nomination with congressional
Senate
confirmation, but why we don't elect the Supreme Court justices. I don't know. I'm of two minds on that matter, because part of it is a Supreme Court justice is supposed to be an expert on constitutional law. They're supposed to be experts on the Constitution. But I find that for probably my, at least the entirety of my adult life where I actually paid attention and cared about what the Supreme Court justice does, or the Supreme Court does, that they they're far less experts on the Constitution and the intention of the the intentions of our founding fathers, you know, and when I say intentions, I mean what, how they interpreted the language in the Constitution. Because if that were the case, we wouldn't have all of these issues with Fourth Amendment and Second Amendment and all of that. Because we would have there would be a definitive. I think the Supreme Court would be much more definitively make a stand on either side of them. And it would be based on fact, you know, and the Constitution, as opposed to an interpretation and, you know, people saying that it's a living document and things change. And yeah, it is a living document, but the way things change are by the amendment process. And the last time we tried to get an amendment through, it was not passed. And as a matter of fact, states who ratified it have since taken away their ratification, not only through the fact that it can only a ratification only lasts for so many years, but some actually pulled it before that time responded. And I'm talking about the Equal Rights Amendment, which was not necessarily a bad thing. That's a whole nother... That's states' rights versus federal government, and I think that's what that came down to, was, well, wait a minute, is this something that should be done at the state level, or is this something that should be done at the federal level? And it's kind of funny, because you have states in this COVID-19, I hate that we're turning this political, but this stuff that's been bugging the hell out of me, but since COVID-19, you have states who are going, we need guidance from the federal government. And that's a shame, because for the way the Constitution is set up and the way state governments and the state constitutions are set up, it should be state before federal. The federal government, as defined by the Constitution, has a very limited scope on what they're responsible for. And unfortunately, again, an issue with the Supreme Court is they've allowed interstate commerce to determine that they have more power, or they've allowed the federal government to accrue more power under the guise of interstate commerce, which is a total misinterpretation of what they're.
But that whole argument is covered anyway, and what I mean by that is, all levels of government have abdicated their responsibilities, not their power, but their responsibilities to someone else. Typically, some sort of bureaucracy that is unelected.
Yeah. Very true.
So the states have been abdicating their power to the federal government for decades. The federal government has been abdicating their responsibility to the federal bureaucracy for even longer than that. I think the solution to all of that is based in the individual. We have to restore responsibility and accountability to ourselves at the most local level and work our way up. It will be a Herculean effort to clean this problem up. But it starts with you and me.
Very true.
And our millions of listeners.
Well, I think we'll stop right there. So I'm Chris, and with me was Matt today, and we want to hear from you, so please send us some feedback. We'll take any kind, text, audio, video, and send it to gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com, and we'll see you on the digital flip side.
listening to Gizmo Sapiens, a technology and entertainment podcast. You can reach us at our email address at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. We'd really love to hear from you, and we'll see you next week from the digital flip side.